Robert Zubin with us as we talk about going to Mars. We're going to take your calls as well when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Bob Zubin with us, and we are talking about going to Mars. We'll get to your calls as well. Robert, realistically, when do you think we can get a human being on the face of Mars?
I think that, if the U.S. government was committed to doing it, I think we could do it within 8 years. If it's less to SpaceX, which admittedly has much smaller resources than Uncle Sam, we could still do it by 2030. And I think they will do it by 2030.
It's not too far away. Now, tell us about the program that you had set up. You were doing some habitat testing and stuff like that?
Well, yeah. The Mars Society, which is a nonprofit that I lead, and which, by the way, is having its next international conference in Pasadena at the Pasadena Convention Center, August 23rd through 26th. If people want to find out about it, go to marssociety.org. The agenda is there, and you can register. You can come and hear the speakers and question the speakers.
Great.
But anyway, what we've done is we have built practice Mars habitats. We call them Mars Analog Research Stations. We have one in the high Arctic of Canada, and we have one in the American desert in southern Utah. And what we do is we send crews of six people there at a time, and they conduct a sustained program of field exploration acting as if they're on Mars. So, for instance, no one can go outside without wearing spacesuits, and they have to do their exploration that way. And then they do their lab work in the habitat, and they interact with our mission support team via satellite, and just like a crew would on Mars. And actually, we have really shown the benefit of human exploration, because in one of our very first motorized excursions, EVAs as we call them, I was actually on that excursion. We traveled north of the Hab about, and this is in Utah, about 5 kilometers. We found this tiny box canyon, and we climbed down into it, and no wheeled rover would have been able to do that.
No way.
And exploring this canyon, we found this unusual rock. And I showed it to the geologist, Jen Heldman, who was there that day and on that EVA, and she said, this looks like bone to me. And we took it back to the Hab, and she thin-sectioned it. She said, this is dinosaur bone. And we reported it to the Bureau of Land Management along with its GPS coordinates. And about 6 years later, a paleontologist from the Burpee Museum in Illinois called up the Bureau of Land Management and said, anybody there find some dinosaur bones? And they said, yeah, the Mars people did around 2002 at these coordinates. Well, they went there and they dug the place out, and it has turned into the largest find of dinosaur bones in North America in 50 years. It's larger than Dinosaur National Monument. Only human explorers could do this. No, you could have parachuted 100 robotic rovers into that desert. You never would have found this, let alone been able to dig it out the way the paleontologists have. So this really shows the value of human explorers on Mars. But we also do things, more broadly. We test out all kinds of field tactics, technologies to find out what's likely to be useful on Mars, what isn't, that kind of thing. So it obviously isn't a real Mars mission. But then again, a military field exercise isn't a real war. No one's trying to kill you. But no competent military would ever think of not having them, because they can learn a lot about tactics by doing it. Or in theater, the dress rehearsal. That's what this is. It's a dress rehearsal. It's a field exercise for trying to learn how we will explore on Mars.
What about the radiation risks, Robert, and the muscle mass problems because of being in space so long?
Well, those are two separate problems. The deterioration of muscle and bone is caused by zero gravity, because, even a person who's not in any way athletic, just walking around on Earth, is, constantly lifting whatever they weigh, 150 pounds, and moving it all over the place. In space, you're in zero G. You don't have that workout, and so unless you work out heavily, on exercise machines and stuff, your muscles and bones will deteriorate. Now, I prefer to get around that by rotating the spacecraft and creating artificial gravity, and that would cure it too, without having to spend 2 hours a day on an exercise machine. Now, the radiation's different. The radiation is, well, you're going to get this radiation dose on the way to Mars, but it's not that big. It's about the amount of radiation, it's about 50 rem going to Mars and back, which is for a 35-year-old man would be about a 1% risk of getting cancer at some point later in your life.
Gosh, that's a higher risk just living on Earth.
Well, yes. I mean, an average smoker takes a 20% risk.
Yeah.
And there are many cities in the United States where just breathing the polluted air is a much bigger risk than that. For example, Houston, and where the astronauts live. So, in fact, it's really kind of crazy to say that the radiation risk of going to Mars is a showstopper when, in fact, living in Houston is a larger cancer risk.
So that we can get to Mars, we don't have to worry about it. Round trip, and how long would they stay? Not talking about those that would stay on the planet for the rest of their lives, but I mean, how long does it take at the closest point where Mars might be to get there?
Well, this year, for example, we have a probe going to Mars this year, and it is taking 6 months to get there. We can get there 6 months pretty much all the time by adding a little extra fuel to the push. So the mission plan for exploration missions would be 6 month trip to Mars, stay on Mars a year and a half, and then a 6 month flight home.
How fast does a rocket ship, once it's in space going to Mars, travel? At what speed?
Oh, about 30 kilometers a second.
30 kilometers a second. Now, if they, and that's without fuel.
So that's like 20 miles a second.
It's like a push. So if we had more fuel, as you suggested, and really lit that rocket in space, could we triple the speed, for example?
Triple, no, but we could go somewhat faster. In principle, you could get to Mars in 3 months instead of six. But the thing is this, it takes a lot more fuel. And if you do the math, you say, if I was going to take triple the fuel and get there in half the time, or would I be better off tripling the payload getting there in the same amount of time and having, you know, a triply redundant light support system so that if it fails, I'd still have one that works. And if that one fails, you're a lot safer taking this more moderate pace. And furthermore, the six-month orbit to Mars has another a safety feature, which is that if you decide that you're not going to go through with it, that is the orbit that will whip past Mars and come back to Earth exactly 2 years after you left. If you try, and so Earth will be there.
Can you imagine being in a ship for 2 years?
Well, yeah, that'd be kind of tough, but I don't think the mission should be built around such abort options. But nevertheless, there it is. It's called the free return. If you try to go to Mars faster than that, and you want to abort the mission, you'll fly out further into the asteroid belt, and it will take you longer than 2 years to come back. And even if you only take 2.1 years to come back, the Earth won't be at the point where you left. In other words, it will only be at the point where you left 1 year after you left, 2 years after you left, or three, you know, like that, because it goes around in a circle. And so if you try to go to Mars faster than that, then the soonest you'd be able to get back to Earth on a free return is 3 years.
Why go to Mars, Robert? Why go to Mars with a human?
Well, it's the closest planet that has on it all the resources needed to support life and therefore civilization. And so it's the planet we can go and explore to find out if life has evolved on other worlds. So that's the scientific reason. But also, it's the closest planet that we can really settle and establish new branches of human civilization.
Is it the planet we would go to in the event of a catastrophe on this planet?
Well, yeah, but I don't think of it that way. I think of it that, first of all, if we go to Mars, if we become a spacefaring species, we'll have the power to, for instance, prevent asteroids from crashing into the Earth. And so rather than saying, here's a place we can run away to if an asteroid's about to hit the Earth, by being a spacefaring species, we'll have the power to stop asteroids from hitting the Earth. And also, I think by being a spacefaring species, we'll have the knowledge that there's room for everyone, that we don't need to fight over living space on Earth, that there's always more out there. And so we don't need to have wars to try to fight over a shrinking pie. We can make the pie bigger, as big as it needs to be.
I always thought of a movie, Robert, where we launch astronauts to go to Mars, and while they're on their way to Mars, they're kind of like looking back at planet Earth as it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and a huge asteroid hits the planet and turns it into a planet killer. There's nothing for them if they came back. And so their whole life was on Mars, and they had to figure out how to survive it. Pretty interesting movie, wouldn't it be?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting movie, but in real life, what I want to do is have us becoming a spacefaring species so we can stop asteroids.
Yeah, I agree. Let's go to the phones. Glenn is with us in Harlingen, Texas. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Good morning, or good evening, George, Robert. How you doing?
Good, Glenn. Thank you.
Robert, I have a question about, absence of a magnetosphere on Mars, and I thought a terraforming project could be accomplished really quickly with a probably a lesson from the past. I read an article where they said that Mars may be fooling us all, that it's never had a magnetosphere, never had a molten core, a rotating molten core. And the geology we're seeing on Mars is probably due to impacts by multiple small moons like Phobos and Deimos, which are in declining orbits and will eventually hit. And there are several low-angle impactors that have scarred the surface, and the geology such as Valle Marineris and Olympus Mons and the lava cauldrons and so forth and so on.
Well, what would the process be, Robert, of terraforming Mars?
Well, okay, so first of all, let me just answer one point that I think the caller was putting forth, which is the absence of a magnetosphere. Without a magnetosphere, Mars's atmosphere would gradually be stripped away by the solar wind. However, that would take hundreds of millions of years. And so while that has had 4 billion years to happen between the birth of Mars and today, and most of the atmosphere has been stripped by that process, or a lot of it, if we terraform Mars and Mars's atmosphere lasts several hundred million years, for practical purposes, that's long enough, right? Now, in terms of how we would terraform Mars, this is how I would do it. First of all, you have to have human settlers on Mars. You have to have a substantial industrial capability on Mars. And then what you would do is start producing super greenhouse gases. That is, you know, we hear about carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, and it is, but we can make artificial greenhouse gases that are like 10,000 times more powerful greenhousing agents than carbon dioxide, molecule for molecule. And one of them, for example, is what's called a perfluoromethane. The chemical formula is CF4. And we could produce this on Mars and put it into the atmosphere. And this stuff is produced on Earth. We use it for refrigeration systems like air conditioners and refrigerators. And if we were producing it on Mars but not putting it in refrigerators, but instead just releasing it to the atmosphere and doing it at the same rate we currently do on Earth, in 50 years we'd warm Mars by 10 centigrade. That's a lot. That's 10 times as much as people are thinking might happen with global warming on Earth in the next 100 years. And so you could warm Mars a lot, and if you did that, that would cause carbon dioxide that's been sponged into the soil to outgas and thicken the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, which is also a greenhouse gas, and there'd be a lot of it, and that would make the atmosphere thick enough for people not to need spacesuits. You'd still need breathing gear because mm-hmm. you could breathe that atmosphere, but you could just walk around with an oxygen mask instead of a whole spacesuit. And now also that would make Mars even warmer, so warm that the ice and the permafrost in the tropics in the mid-latitudes would start to melt, and the rivers on Mars would start to flow again, the lakes would start to fill up again, and there would be rain. And on that Mars, you could start spreading plants all over the place. Now, and they would start making oxygen. Now, if the only way you had to make oxygen was by using plants, and if the plants were the same kind of plants that we're familiar with on Earth today, it would take 1,000 years for them to put enough oxygen in Mars's atmosphere for people to breathe.
For the whole planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we could spread the plants, and, of course, once the plants are there, they start spreading themselves, too. But it would take 1,000 years. But here's the thing. If we're talking about people starting this 50 or 100 years from now, it's hardly beyond imagination that using genetic engineering, we could create plants that are much more efficient at photosynthesis than the kind of plants that we see. In other words, the plants like grass and so forth, they're about 1% efficient at photosynthesis. They're 1% efficient at using the energy of sunlight to turn carbon dioxide.
Yeah, you want to increase that somehow.
Yeah, so let's say you can make it 5%. Well, then this would happen a lot faster.
That would be an interesting take. And how would you, I mean, it doesn't rain on Mars, so if you were going to plant things like trees and other shrubs, how would you water them?
It would rain on this Mars. In other words, once we've warmed it, so that the frozen water on Mars becomes liquid and the streams of Mars are flowing again and the lakes are filling and the oceans are filling, then there would be rain.
Realistically, how long can this take?
Well, I think that this initial warming process with the fluorocarbon gas might take 50 years, and then CO2 to thicken the atmosphere substantially. Well, it would keep thickening it for time, but it would get the atmosphere pretty thick within another 50 years, and at that point you'd start seeing rain and flowing rivers, and then you could start spreading plants, and also microbes. There are microbes that will produce methane, which is also a greenhouse gas, a very strong one, and that will add to the effect as well. So. You might say we know how to warm a planet. We're showing that right now on Earth, but it's Mars is the one that needs the warming, and if we're trying to warm it instead of just doing a little bit of warming accidentally, we can do a hell of a job. We can make Mars much more Earth-like. And now, if you think about it though for a second, this is humans just doing what life has always done. What life has always done is taking unfavorable environments and making them better for life.
And fixing them. That's right. Yeah, Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here. We'll continue chatting about going to Mars, and we'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we talk about dreams. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. We're back with our final segment with Robert Zubrin as we talk about going to Mars. Let's go back to the calls. Thomas in La Jolla, California. Hey, Thomas, welcome.
Hi, George. You know, George, I want to thank you and your staff for the miracle of Coast to Coast seven nights a week. It's truly appreciated.
Thank you.
Robert, my question is about, you know, some scientists think that you can utilize a moon base on the surface of the moon as a way station to Mars and the rest of the solar systems. But there are other scientists who believe that the more important spots are the Lagrange points near the moon, not on the moon. They're called Lagrange 4 and Lagrange 5, also known as L4 and L5. And as I understand it, they are like gravitational dead zones. You can park a very large space station at L4 or L5, and it would not orbit the moon. It would actually stay stationary. And I was wondering if you could, is it possible that the Lagrange points, L4 and L5, would be an important way station to Mars?
They could be used. Okay, so first of all, you are correct that L4, L5 are places, stable places where you can put things and they will kind of travel around the Earth in the moon's orbit, either 60 degrees in front of it or 60 degrees behind it. So they are places where you can park things. They're not really necessary as places to go on your way to Mars. If you were at L4 or L5, you could drop down from there and do a close pass by the Earth and then fire a rocket engine and you'd be on your way to Mars. But you could do the same thing by just firing the rocket engine close to Earth. That is using the same energy as it would have taken to get to L4, using that energy plus the energy you'd have to do for the kick after you went to L4, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. It doesn't really help you go to Mars. It is a place of some interest for putting space telescopes. You could keep them in orbit around the Earth but not be that close or that close to the moon. They were places where Gerard O'Neill wanted to put solar power satellites. I don't know about that plan, but if you had solar power satellites, you could put them there. I don't think they're critical way stations on the way to Mars. They are stable locations. You can park things there. That's true. The surface of the moon, it gives you access to the moon, and it gives you access to things like ice in the permanently shadowed craters near the poles. If I wanted to do the moon, I would go to the moon, and I'd establish a base near the south pole of the moon on the hills where the sun is always shining, right next to the craters where the sun is never shining and where the ice is to be found.
Could you terraform the moon realistically?
No, you can't terraform
you can't.
The moon. There isn't enough gravity on the moon to hold an atmosphere.
Nah. Well, next up, let's go to Gary in the state of Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Robert. Good evening to you both.
You too.
I was wondering, Robert, if you were able to contact Captain Randy Kramer of the Marine Corps, if he might have some insight as to the problems you might face.
I'm not familiar with him. Tell me a little more about him.
He's the Marine captain who alleges to be part of the USMC SS, which is the special section, which they're on Mars already, have been since the 50s.
Yeah, what do you think of those theories that some people have come up with, Robert, that we've been to Mars with humans already? And we've got bases. I think I know what you're going to say, but I'm going to let you say it.
I don't believe it.
Next up, Jeff in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hey, Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hi, Robert. Hi, George. This is Jeff. I'm a member of the Mars Society, Robert, but I can't make a conference next week, unfortunately. So I have two questions for you. With the large dust storm now going on Mars and political problems with getting space nuclear power generators flown. Can we do Mars direct and establish Mars colony with solar power only? And my second question is, don't we need a large radius rotating spacecraft to test out artificial gravity before we get to Mars? Maybe that would be better than a lunar gateway space station. So the two questions are, can we use solar power only for Mars direct, and should Mars Society advocate for a large rotating spacecraft?
Okay, well, you can use solar power on Mars, but you do face this issue of unreliability due to the dust storms. Now, this is the first dust storm of this extent that we've had on Mars since, for instance, the Opportunity rover landed there in 2004. This is the first time that it's been confronted by this. There was a dust storm comparable to this in, I think, 1971. So these things happen every number of years, and if they happen you're depending on solar power, you're out of luck. And that is why the best plan would be one that uses space nuclear power. And so I think we should have it's good they're doing the kilopower reactor, but that's a small one. I think we should have a program to build a 100-kilowatt nuclear reactor. That'd be adequate for Mars Direct, and that would work just fine, dust storm or not. Now, in terms of artificial gravity, you can make a large spinning spacecraft, but that is heavy. The way that we do it, for instance, in the Mars Direct mission, is you use a booster with an upper stage that throws the spaceship to Mars, and that means the upper stage is flying to Mars too. And so what you do is you extend a tether, a cable, between the spacecraft and the upper stage, and you spin the assembly around. The burnt-out upper stage acts as a counterweight. So you have two objects on opposite ends of a string, and you spin that, and you can create artificial gravity that way. And so if you're asking me, would it be more useful to have an artificial gravity space station as kind of a testing a trans-Mars spaceship close to Earth, that would have some use, certainly much more use than a lunar orbiting space station that does nothing.
And why should we not go to Venus? Just too hot?
Yeah, Venus is much too hot. Venus, the surface of Venus is hot enough to melt lead. Now, if you're flying in the clouds of Venus, like let's say you had a dirigible and you could be flying at the Venus' atmosphere is very thick. At the surface, it's 90 times as thick as Earth's atmosphere.
Jeez.
So if you're way up in the sky at the level where it's the same thickness as Earth's atmosphere, interestingly enough, the temperature is about the same as it is on Earth. So if you wanted to go to Venus, if you stayed in an airship and stayed at high altitude, you could do it. But I don't see the point because you can't go to the surface.
Let's go to Jeff in Birmingham, Alabama now. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead, sir.
Just a couple of things. The Mars Base Camp lander, I rather like that because that's going to be hydrolox, which might actually be a better fit than methalox with recent water finds. The BFR does worry me a bit because, to me, the word composite and the word cryogenic shouldn't be used in the same sentence. I understand one of his tanks ruptured for the BFS part of his dual BFR-BFS architecture. But one question, the scuttlebutt I've heard is that Bezos' new Armstrong Super Heavy might come in at 30 meters wide. What have you heard about that? Because that might be able to launch a pretty good-sized cycler just by itself.
Well, 30-meter diameter rocket, that's radical. I believe the BFR is about 9, if I'm not mistaken. The new Glenn is about 7. So I'd be quite surprised if the Armstrong came in above 12. Now, of course, that'd still be pretty husky. To me, the big question mark about Blue Origin is when are they going to start turning it on? They have more resources, certainly, than SpaceX. But they're being Sputniked, and
yeah, they are.
Sooner or later, you know, if they want to compete in the race, they got to start running.
And they've got the brain power, don't they, Robert?
Oh, certainly. There's plenty of very smart people at Blue Origin, it's a great company. But one must say that you've got. Like Musk is like Rommel. He's a desert fox. He moves fast. And these guys are taking it step by step. And we'll see what happens. These are two different approaches to trying to get the job done. And, the Blue Origin, their slogan is step by step ferociously, and Musk is running a blitzkrieg. So we'll see.
Let's go to first-time caller Randall in Greenville, South Carolina. Hi, Randall. You there?
Yes, sir.
Well, you unfortunately need to call us back if you could. That's a bad connection. So, Robert, your Mars Society event is coming up August 23rd. I'd love to be there, but I'm in Asheville, North Carolina at the time. But people can get the info off your website, marssociety.org.
That's right, marssociety.org, and you scroll down just a little bit, you'll see a poster for the conference, and then you'll see the agenda a tab, and you can click on it. You'll see all the different talks. I'll be talking. We've got scientists talking about the search for life on Mars. We've got somebody talking about the Mars helicopter. We've got a panel debate on this deep space or the lunar orbit space station. we have there's going to be a new Mars TV series called The First, and the producer and the cast of that are coming for
us. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Now, have you had a chance to talk with the professor, Bruce Jakowski?
Yeah, no, I've talked to him in the past. I haven't talked to him personally about this latest paper of his. But interestingly, I had an argument with him about 20 years ago where he had produced a study that showed that there couldn't be water ice on Mars except at the poles. That is, there could not be at mid-latitudes like 40 north. And I said, look, you know, your model is fine, but it's like it has Mars as a perfect sphere with no hills, no nothing. What about the north side of the hill? You know, like here in Colorado, it's August, but you can go out into the mountains and find places where there's still snow on the ground because it's shaded in such a way. And, well, it's turned out that we now have found ice at mid-latitudes on Mars, lots of it, and in protected places. And so, you know, Mars is a complicated place, and who knows the discoveries we're going to make. But the one thing that I find, you know, objectionable about Jakowski's paper is what Jakowski is an expert on is the MAVEN satellite, which has measured how much CO2 Mars has lost.
Mm-hmm.
It has not measured how much CO2 Mars has. And so he's giving the impression that he knows how much CO2 Mars has, and he doesn't. Now, I don't either. Nobody does. We're not going to know until we go and explore and do the assessment.
Can't we pick it up from instruments from the rover?
We know what the atmosphere is, but the issue is how much CO2 is soaked into the soil. And the deepest the rovers have dug into the soil is a couple of inches.
We might have a better connection with Randall in South Carolina. Let's give it a try. Go ahead, Randall.
Yes, sir. I had a question about the meteor explosion over the air base in Greenland.
Yes.
And how, like, the U.S. military failed to, like, report it. And what your guys' opinion on that was.
Okay, we had the story earlier this week over the airbase there, and that he is correct. The military did fail to report it. Had you heard about that meteorite, Robert?
No, I hadn't heard about that one. But
I mean, it blew up in the atmosphere. It didn't hit the ground.
Right. And it's good that they did not mistake it for something.
Yes, like an incoming. Missile. Yeah.
Right.
That's all
okay.
We need.
And, you know, a lot of people don't know. In October 1990, a small asteroid hit the Earth. It hit in the South Pacific. And to the best of anyone's knowledge, it didn't kill anyone, even though it hit with more power than the Hiroshima bomb.
Mm-hmm. And no tsunami.
Okay, and no tsunami. But you know what? If it had hit Earth about 10 hours later, it would have landed right in the middle of the American forces assembling for the Desert Storm War with Iraq.
Oh.
Okay, and
we would have thought somebody launched on us.
We would have thought someone had nuked us. Yep, that's what we would have thought.
And we would have retaliated.
It's overdue that we start being able to defend ourselves against these things.
I think so, too. Robert, you're writing another book. What's it going to be on?
Well, it's going to be on the space revolution that's happening right now, this thing that's going on in front of our eyes, this, you know, where these entrepreneurial space companies are launching, and it's going to cheapen the cost of space flight, and it's going to open up possibilities in Earth orbit, the moon, Mars, the asteroids, outer solar system, and the stars. That's what it's going to talk about. And it's also going to talk about what this means to society and also what it would mean if we somehow let this thing be stopped.
That's going to be exciting. Robert, thanks again. Always nice talking to you.
All right. Thank you for having me. Let's do it again.
You got it. Robert Zubrin, who he was also a guest of mine on Beyond Belief, did a great, great job. Up next, it's called Mindful Dreaming, Harnessing the Power of Lucid Dreaming for happiness, health, and positive change. Looking forward to this. We're going live to Germany next.